Hi guys, welcome to the Google Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Watson, and I've got a really fascinating guest who's speaking with us today over in Toronto, Canada. His name's Simon Essler, who fights for free thought with every tool he has. After building a free-thinking 14,000-member think tank on Facebook, Simon was censored across social media for challenging official narratives. In response, he pivoted his focus to providing content to freedom-orientated streaming platforms, refining his skills as a researcher, content creator and filmmaker within private communities. After almost half a decade of writing, shooting and editing original content focused on modern warfare from a psychological, cultural and spiritual perspective, Simon decided to release his first independent project for the public at large, which is Cut: Daughters of the West, which is an investigation into cosmetic surgery, feminist sexual liberation and modern media trends as part of the warp legacy that has been handed to young girls as a foundation for the gender ideology to take hold. So firstly, Simon, I really appreciate you taking the time with me today.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be on. Thank you for having me.
So before we kind of dive in and talk about the documentary, I'd just be really interested to get a bit of perspective on a bit of an understanding on what kind of first inspired you to sort of go along this path and to which helped you form the mission to win the ongoing war against free thought and human liberty.
So, you know, I've been kind of on the outside of things in terms of, I guess, my perspective on the world for a long time. I had a lot of very expansive spiritual paranormal experiences growing up that I think laid a foundation for me to investigate things that were outside of, you know, official narratives, official perspectives. You know, when I was growing up, I realized very early on in looking at, you know, for example, the wars that were ongoing in the world. It was very clear to me as a teenager that wars were something that were created, that they were sort of fomented by people who benefited from them to a great extent. Some of the larger wars that were going on in the world. I think that the Gulf War was a big one that really woke me up to it. And, you know, as a teenager, I was very critical of our culture and the way our cultural environment impacted us. I was actually specifically really disturbed as a teenager about the way that culture impacted girls. It always deeply bothered me the way that girls had to struggle to become women and what girls were up against. And, you know, I watched this just from the perspective of my own social group. You know, growing up, I noticed that girls really, they had to commit to the idea of, you know, guys that didn't treat them very well. They would often find their connections with guys that treated them poorly and not so much with guys that treated them with respect. And there were kinds of mimicry, I guess, I saw going on between our culture and the actual girls in my neighborhood and in my school, where it seemed that, you know, girls' bodies were treated poorly, and that the idea of becoming a sexual being for a girl was a very scary and strange process. Actually, a great number of the girls that I was close with growing up faced rape. They had all been sexually abused in some way or another. It was so common. So there was a part of me that was very struck very young by our culture, and specifically by the way that our culture impacted girls. So I was very counterculture growing up. I got into theater when I was in high school, and that ended up taking me down the path to university. And I studied in university what was called collective creation. And this was a specific theater program that I went to that was about collectively creating forms of theater in terms of people sharing the responsibilities of writing, acting, directing, and all the different ways that a story and a piece of theater is created. And that really informed my sense of artistic creation, because one of the main things that we were taught in that program was your restrictions will free you. If you create a proper container for your art, then that will free your art to share itself with the world. That if you move into something without the proper restrictions, without the proper container, then it will not be as impactful. I think that really fed into my sense of fighting against you know, this war on free thought and human liberty, because I now see that as part of the restrictions, the containers that I'm facing. And I now feel very inspired by the war that we are in and the modern warfare that we face daily, because I see that as the proper restriction for me. And that has given me a sense of purpose. And so I became very fascinated with the study of modern warfare. And that's something I've made content on for years now. And so now I'm in this place where I'm very focused on, rather than feeling oppressed or victimized by this massive war that, you know, that's full of psychological operations and propaganda and disinformation, rather than being beaten down by it or feeling like a victim, I'm now in a place where I feel like it inspires my sense of purpose and it clarifies my sense of service to humanity on an ongoing basis. And so I've taken that philosophy that I learned in university and that sort of sense of disturbance that I developed when I observed our culture as a teenager, and it's really informed where I'm at now, and very much so the work that I'm currently offering to the world.
Wow, that's fascinating background. And am I right in thinking you became a minister as well at some point, a spiritual minister?
Yeah, so I that actually came from, you know, I guess that's rooted in my fascination initially with meditation. So when I was a teenager, my parents introduced me to transcendental meditation. And so I tried that out and it was interesting, but what it did was it hooked me into a fascination with meditation in a broader sense. And so I studied as many different kinds of meditation as I could. I became fascinated with mantra-based meditations, open-eye meditations, closed-eye meditations, guided, not guided, you know, breath-based work, all sorts of, you know, different techniques into different states of consciousness. Once I studied that for years and practiced all these different types, I actually ended up launching a business that was based on guided meditation. And I opened this practice called Thunderheart Guidance. And some of it was doing one-on-one work. People would come to my space and I would do these really, really deep guided meditations with people and take them into, you know, the deepest meditative states that they had experienced, and then try to give them the tools to go and duplicate that at home without the guidance. And that ended up moving into working with like high level CEOs and people running companies. And, you know, I worked with a funeral home, helping the staff at the funeral home with guided meditation. I ended up working with their bereavement center. I ended up running a program to help people with the bereavement process using mindfulness and meditation. And so that practice very much got me oriented towards guiding people spiritually and using specifically ritual, you know, ritual and forms of ceremony really to alter our relationship with life. Because meditation, so much of it, I realized, was the ritual steps that you take to get into it. It's not just you sitting down and doing certain inner techniques. Like, what do you do to prepare? You know, how do you set your space up? How do you communicate to your space that it's time for you to meditate? What are the rituals that lead up to it? And what are the rituals that take you out of the meditation? Because I also found that if you come out of a meditation too quickly, you lose a lot of what you've gained. But when you have ritual steps out of it, you tend to take more away. So I developed a fascination with ritual and ceremony, and I ended up becoming certified as what's called a life cycle celebrant. This is was through the Celebrant Foundation and Institute. And so I studied with them, and what they do is they teach people about, first of all, the history of ceremony and ritual, but then they teach you about the art of custom ceremony creation and what it means to take something that someone is moving through in their life cycle and to create a ceremony that speaks specifically to that part of that person's life cycle. Where I really started off with this was doing wedding ceremonies. So once I was certified as a life cycle celebrant, I went and worked with a place called the Bancroft Center for Awakening Spiritual Growth. And this was a church here in Ontario that I became ordained through. And they're very, very much open to supporting people's spiritual paths, but not through a particular dogma. And that was really a fascination of mine, because I wanted to work with people both in and outside religious framework, because that's really where I was coming from. I had studied different religious texts and inspirations, but I wasn't one to submit to a particular dogma. So I ended up opening a wedding practice as a minister, and I worked with couples to create custom wedding ceremonies. And this background gave me the ability to take, you know, for example, at a couple where, you know, the woman, she was of Chinese background and the man was of Jamaican background, and they wanted to create a ceremony that you know, infuse their different cultures and their different perspectives on life. And that's what this training gave me the ability to do. And so couples would fill out these extensive questionnaires, and then I would take the responses from their questionnaire that was really questions guiding me through their love story and their story as individuals, and weaving that all into a ceremony that tells the story of these people and their unique paths intertwining. And so I did that for many years, these custom wedding ceremonies. And while I'm not practicing in that regard anymore, after the lockdowns and the wedding industry was so impacted, I decided to move my career path in a different direction. But I'm now focused on using my skills that I developed as a minister and as a life cycle celebrant to help parents create rites of passages for their children. And that's sort of my next big focus, on using that skill set that I gathered when I was a minister.
Wow, that's incredible, hearing that backstory and how that's evolved. So I imagine having all that grounding in spirituality and meditation and mindfulness and using all the breath work has helped you, because you're obviously looking at some stuff which we'll get into now. You know, it's you shine the light on darkness, but for you to be able to do that, you know, you have to have hold your center, don't you, in many ways. Otherwise, you can see a lot of people who might go down rabbit holes and explore stuff, and they can potentially get lost. They become burnt out as well by looking at it, becoming a bit of an activist and stuff and looking at it. I'm sure that's been a good grounding for you as you've kind of moved in to sort of shine the light on some of the, let's say, some of the things that have not exactly serving humanity for the best at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I've learned is that when we are impacted by something, for me, I'll say this is true for me. This might not be the true experience for everyone, but I think for a lot of people, when we are impacted by something, especially something very dark, there is a kind of emotional wave that is generated in us. And I think the reason it's important to see it as a wave is that it has a crest, it has a peak, but then it's also something that settles. And what I found is that if I don't make choices for myself, but also artistic choices, if I refrain from making those choices when I'm at the peak of the wave, it's actually best. And what seems to be true is then when that wave, if I wait until the wave subsides, there is a great deal of clarity when you allow an emotional wave to crest and find its natural ending. And at the end of that emotional wave, there are forms of clarity that I think give us great purpose and a great sense of direction. And that's part of the process I've tried to embody, is that sometimes looking at this work, you know, I'll hit a real place of darkness. I'll make a discovery that really, you know, I have to sit down and cry and work through it, but I don't make any artistic choices or any choices for myself while I'm going through that. I allow that. And if I wait, the amount of clarity that comes at the end of an emotional wave is very, very purposeful. And I think that's also part of the experience I hope to create for others, you know, in the work that I've created with this film and in the work that I'm looking to create in the future, is I want to create these experiences of emotional waves, but I guess the difference between what I want to do with that and sort of propaganda that's manipulative is that I'm not looking to manipulate people at the peak of the emotion, which I think is what propaganda does in a sort of harmful way. I really want people to come to that crest and that moment of stillness after the wave, so that there is a moment of clarity and understanding that isn't based in stress, but it's based in allowing our emotionality to serve our path and our intelligence in the world.
So on that, let's discuss. So the documentary that's been out, Cut, Daughters of the West, if you could give us a little bit of an overview of that and talk us through what you explored, that'd be really interesting.
So, you know, I had already researched the impact of gender ideology on children in a broader sense. I had made a docuseries before Cut called Superorganism. And Superorganism was focused on the war on the natural family, on the traditional family unit. And I was looking at comparing the war on the family to an ideal of the family unit, that is this ideal of the family as a superorganism. You know, I was fascinated by this idea of a man and a woman coming together and having a child, and the biological, spiritual, and psychological systems that are present when that happens being this perfect superorganism for generating human wisdom and cultivating that wisdom, and then using you know, the lineage of the family to pass human wisdom and knowledge down the line. And what is it like to look at the human traditional family unit as an ideal superorganism for that purpose? So that was what I had been working on before this that led me down the path of looking into the impact of gender ideology. But in that series, I looked at it in a broader sense of how is it affecting innocence? How is it affecting children? How is it affecting their relationships with their parents? But I ended up finding out that this was impacting girls much more than it was boys, in a way that greatly disturbed me. And I think sort of harkened me back to some of those sensibilities that I had as a teenager, that there's something bigger going on here. This is part of a long-term trend in the way that girls and women have been treated in our culture. And I was watching the way the media was dealing with this, and especially, like, I think media extremes on both sides of the political spectrum. So not just left-wing media, but right-wing media as well. And I was watching the ways that this issue was getting entrenched into politicized narratives that I didn't really feel were helpful or necessarily accurate to what was going on, because I had this long-term sense of something being awry in our culture, that women and girls were being misled deeply. So I was called to look at this from a broader perspective. And what I ended up doing was researching the history of cosmetic surgery and looking at, you know, how did we get to this point where cultural trends can dictate permanent body modification? Like, how did we even get to that basic foundational point in our culture? How did that norm develop? And then I ended up finding out much more than I even thought I would in digging into the cosmetic surgery industry, namely that it is really only for women and girls, that 92 to 94% of cosmetic surgery is performed on women and girls. And then I ended up uncovering that in addition to this explosion of girls transitioning and seeking out these medical treatments, there is this rise of teenage labiaplasties, which is girls getting cosmetic genital surgery. And that was just more than enough evidence to me that we are not seeing the bigger picture here. And if we get caught up in the idea that this is a war between the left and the right side of politics, then we are going to miss all these massive cultural undercurrents that were actually the soil for this explosion. They created the initial justification for treating the body as an obstacle instead of becoming an embodied adult.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, when I watch it and some of the things, like some things that stood out, I think it was some statistics that you're showing, particularly in the UK, that showed in a 10-year period, there was something like a 4,400% increase in teenage girls seeking that gender treatments. You know, that's, you know, totally unnatural. And to think that people, I hear some people say, oh, well, you know, people can, we're in a climate now where people can say, maybe express their feelings and emotions more, but even that case, that's not going to jump up 44 times in increase. And and one other thing, it makes me think, because there's actually a town in the UK here called, it's called Blackpool, and it's got a very high number of children in looked after care. And it just so happens that that's also got the highest number of girls who are looking to transition as well. So, and it also reminds me of Ellen Page, who's now Elliot Page. You know, but I understand that she's had so much sexual abuse entering the industry when she was a young teenager, that it's no wonder really that these children, which were children, want to escape the body. And just to sort of bypass that and think by them transitioning that they're suddenly going to solve all the problems, it's just, it was obviously not the case, because I think you touch in the documentary that actually, you know, after that, the more likely there's even higher risk for them for suicide after they've done the transition.
Yeah. Yeah. That does seem to be the case. And those statistics are not, you know, they're not very convenient for the people trying to promote this. But it does seem to be the case that the suicide rate is higher after transition, because we're dealing with a lot of other conditions. A lot, like you said, there's often early trauma. You have, you know, kids coming from either no family or very dysfunctional families. You also have a very high rate of girls that are autistic who are being transitioned, or girls that have personality disorders. So of course, if they go through this process of blocking their puberty and then having a double mastectomy and injecting themselves with testosterone, and then it's after that that they realize, wait, I was just autistic, or wait, I was bipolar, or whatever that ends up being, then of course there is this struggle with suicidal ideation and suicide attempts, because the mistake that's been made is so grave and so difficult. You know, when we look at the detransitioners that are speaking out, and some of them I include their stories in my film, those are just the girls that have been able to climb out of the absolute despair and share their story to the world. But you have to understand, there are girls who are never going to be able to climb out of that pit of despair. And those are some of the girls, I believe, that make up that statistic of, you know, the rise in suicide after transition. There's a big pushback to say this can't be a social contagion. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to address very strongly with this film, that girls are prone to social contagions. That's why I think it's so relevant that you have this rise in girls getting labiaplasties at the same time. And that whole issue, you know, I've come to realize, I've done more research since making the film, and it's proven my point even more. The labiaplasty industry is based off of incorrect notions of female anatomy. And what seems to be happening is that a lot of the girls and women that are getting labiaplasties, this cosmetic genital surgery, just to make their genitalia look better, so to speak, they're actually getting permanent nerve damage. A lot of them are losing the ability to orgasm. They're being terribly, terribly maimed. And it's so similar, because this is doctors who are ill-informed, who are performing these surgeries. It means you have parents who are consenting to get their minor children into these cosmetic surgeries. You have a lot of the same factors. And so to me, it's very obvious that girls are prone to social contagions, but moreover, that there are plenty of parents that won't protect them from social contagions, because clearly we don't have enough understanding of this phenomenon to be protecting girls in the correct way.
And it seems very much like it ties back into your previous work with this, you know, the 6-series documentary that you made about the family unit. And if you're going to fragment that family unit, you're going to make it feel like the state is going to raise your children, and, you know, the parents are all working ridiculous hours, or they've got their own issues and stuff. It's very easy then to see how, you know, this sort of connects with that.
Absolutely. To me, so much of what we're looking at ties back to the war on the family. I'm a very passionate advocate about this, because I think that also gets caught up in narratives. The debates that tend to unfold around that, they get caught up in narratives, specifically, I would say, more religious or anti-religious narratives, because, you know, the Christian community has been alone in trying to stand against this war on the family for a long time. You haven't had voices outside of the Christian community really articulating what's going on from a non-religious perspective. And I think that has been, to an extent, to a disadvantage, because then a lot of people write it off as just, that's just, you know, Christian orthodoxy. It's just the Christians being extreme, or they're creating a Christian moral panic, when in fact it is very correct that there is a war on the family. And when I looked into this, you know, I found it to be very well organized, that the war on the family is very organized into operations that are targeting the men and the fathers, operations that are targeting the women and the mothers, and operations that are targeting the children and their innocence. And the organization of this warfare, it is definitely to disrupt the family unit, but towards a specific end. And that specific end seems to be to reorder our society into what a lot of people call the New World Order, this idea of a more globalized society, and this top-down world government that dissolves the power of nation states. That seems to be part of what they want to do. There were documents that I relied on in my docuseries Superorganism called the Toronto Protocols. Now, these are alleged meetings that occurred in Toronto between this group of global financiers. And, you know, they're very interesting to read, because they're very, very specific in the way they unpack the war that they are waging to install a new world order. And I think what's most fascinating about these documents is they don't actually name anyone. You don't know who's in these meetings. They just claim to be these global financiers. They call themselves the 666. So there is a sort of reference to them being satanic. And in it, they sort of explicitly say that one of our major obstacles to installing the new world order is the family unit. We need to essentially destroy the family unit, the idea of the family unit, the parts of society that lend themselves to the stability of family. And they pretty much lay out that one of the reasons they want to do this is because they don't want the family to be able to pass on knowledge down through the generations. They want to stop that process so that children who come from families that aren't passing on a lineage of knowledge on how to live a healthy, beautiful, spiritual life, if they can cut off that lineage of knowledge, then the children who come from those families are reliant upon the state. They are reliant upon the media and the school system to orient themselves. So they will take in what those sources give them to develop their identities and their sense of the world and their sense of right and wrong. If they are coming from families that don't carry a healthy lineage of that, and that seemed to be in these documents what they laid out very, very explicitly, that from a warfare perspective, they need to stop the flow of human knowledge and wisdom. And that's part of why I tried to counter that with this idea of the family as a superorganism, because I felt like, well, if they're saying that that's what the family is good for and they need to stop the family from providing us with that, you know, that capacity, then what is it like to take the opposite view of how incredible is the family at doing that? And so I studied that. And I think a lot of what we're dealing with will just, people will realize more and more over time that we're looking at a longstanding war on the family, which again, as I said earlier, it very much informs you, because it means if you're in a position to create a stable, loving family and to generate a legacy of human wisdom, then you are correctly fighting back in this war, in my opinion.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Have you come across someone called, is it Jennifer Bilek, who, and I watched an amazing interview with her recently, and she talks how there's an intersect between what's happening now and potentially transhumanism agenda. And that's almost like, you know, potentially that's the bigger goal in terms of a few decades down the line, what they're attempting to do.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this is something that, I think in a way, the structure of my film sort of shows it a lot, because you're looking at the philosophy of permanent body modification as a way of life, as a means of self-realization being normalized over the years, right? This message that your body is an obstacle and to be who you are, you need to physically, medically, technologically overcome the body. This is really a core philosophy of transhumanism. And so when we look at those themes in just the cosmetic surgery industry right now, and when we look at those themes with where gender ideology takes things, where it says, you know, the body is just a modifiable series of parts. If you don't feel like you're a woman, then you cut your breasts off and you get a penis made, and you know, you just build new parts, because this is nothing but a series of parts. This is a very transhumanist way of looking at the body. And I very much agree with her perspective. And she proves it quite empirically in that there is, you know, there's funding being poured into the, you know, the industry of transitioning children that is coming from sources who are very open about their transhumanist position. But I think there's one really clear way to this. You know, Hitler was very much against Marxists. You know, there's this quote from Hitler where he essentially said, "I hate Marxists, but I used Marxism for my towards my own end. I used the Marxist operations. I used the Marxist tactics, even though I hated Marxists and I don't agree with them." You can really compare that to someone like Klaus Schwab, who, you know, he's working with his World Economic Forum and he's influencing the cabinets of the world. He's stating that he's penetrated the cabinets of the world, and he includes Justin Trudeau as an example of that. And he's very, very openly a transhumanist, and not I would say, someone who's openly a Marxist. You couldn't say that Klaus Schwab is a Marxist activist. I very much see it in the same way, that he presents us with a larger strategy, you know, a sort of larger operation that's ongoing to move us towards transhumanism. And within that larger operation, you have Marxist and neo-Marxist forms of warfare as a tactic. And they just see that as a means for reorganizing the way that our society interacts, you know, on many different levels, and changing the way people cognize, so that they can later on install the ideals of transhumanism. That's very much how I see it at this point. And I think it is important for people to understand that when we're looking at things like gender ideology and critical race theory, all of this is very provably neo-Marxist. It is very, very obviously neo-Marxism. And that's something I'm working on a lot of material to help teach people how that actually, how we got from Marx and his original documents into, you know, gender ideology and critical race theory, and how that is the new version of Marxism and how that's being used.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're living at a time now, aren't we, where there's a few different train tracks, there's a few different paths that we can go down. And if we don't do anything, we're just going to get swept along down that path. But if we can start with ourselves to sort of make that choice, like for yourself, like I think how brave you are putting this information out. You know, at some point, you know, you said, I think you had a group on Facebook, which obviously got shut down, but you'll just continue to put it out because there's something inside you that you know inside you that, you know, you have to do this. And I think the more of us that can be aware of this and wake up, and because you can see at the moment, people are very terrified of being cancelled, you know, and, you know, we've seen it particularly the past 3 or 4 years. I know even that Jennifer Bilek would say it to go back to almost 2013. If anyone even started to question stuff around gender, they would just, you know, they'd get shut down. But yeah, we're at this time now where if we can come together, we can share this information. It does feel to me in some ways like the tide is turning. You know, it feels like they're pushing that hard with it, that they're making it sloppy in many ways, and it just doesn't hold up. You know, if you hold it up to the light, it doesn't make any sense. And I think, you know, you've got Matt Walsh with his documentary, What is a Woman? And that was streamed on Twitter the other week and had 170 million views in a weekend. That's over 2% of the world's population watched that documentary in that weekend. That far exceeds any film or anything that's ever been seen in one weekend. And of course, we've got the backlash with big brands like Bud Light and Target recently. You were seeing massive share drops. And I think it was Starbucks had pulled all their Pride branding from all the stores part of the way through because they're kind of... So you can see there's a shift. And I'd just like to... Yeah, so it's now us building momentum on that to sort of, you know, to just shine a light on it.
So there's a really clear way that I've come to see sort of where we're at and what we're really up against. In modern warfare, there's something called asymmetrical warfare, okay? And so this was, you know, war evolved. It got to the point where it was no longer about two forces of equal strength coming up against each other, like two armies, for example. Asymmetrical warfare began to develop when small radical groups could use, you know, modern tactics to take on larger entities. So when very small radicalized groups, they could be centralized or decentralized, could attack a whole government or a whole military or, you know, a whole nation, really. You know, we're looking at this ability of, you know, Davids to take on Goliath. So asymmetrical warfare is something that has evolved to become quite sophisticated. And so you're looking at a form of warfare now where you can have a minority group take on a majority. And I think that's a big part of what we're confronted with right now. Those of us standing up against this, it's so important to remember that we are the majority and that there is a lot of effort being put into the media landscape and the censorship on social media and big tech to make it feel like perhaps we are not the majority, to make it feel like maybe we're up against a group that's similar in size to us. And I would state very firmly that we are not. that those of us who are standing against all of this are absolutely the majority. But at the same time, we are dealing with an enemy who is very good at sophisticated forms of asymmetrical warfare. They're very good at using narratives, sort of narrative warfare, to get a small group of radicals very riled up, very upset, very sort of mind controlled, and then uplifting the voice of that small radicalized group and using this massive media apparatus to make that group seem much, much bigger and much more powerful. That's a lot of what we're dealing with. And so, you know, we saw that, I think, a lot during COVID. I think there was a lot of that. You know, there was a lot of work to try to make it seem like everyone was on board for this and people who stood against it were a radical minority. And I don't really think that was the case. And I think also, you know, there are some documents that came out about psychological warfare operations being waged against Canadians. They were actually, there's documents that came out showing that they were trying to study behavioral sciences to get more Canadians to take the injection. And their conclusion was the kitchen sink model. So throw everything at them at the kitchen sink. So they were literally, the conclusion they came to was every psychological form of warfare we can wage at them to get them to take this injection, we must wage. And that to me shows desperation. And I think it shows the kind of resistance they were facing. So I think there's two things I really want people to take away from the understanding of asymmetrical warfare. Number one is that you should be careful if you are being made to feel like you're part of a minority pushback, because you're not. But number two, to not underestimate our enemy in that they don't need a majority to continue to do what they're doing. They have been using a minority set of voices this whole time. They're very adept at doing that. And so we need to be aware of that ongoing tactic as we continue to fight for free thought and human liberty and all of that.
It's very much like a chess game, isn't it? And I think from their perspective, they are thinking many moves ahead, many years ahead, and they've got the time, they've got the money, they've got the resources. And like you said, if they throw the kitchen sink at people, those people are just in survival mode and are just, you know, all the senses are, you know, on alert, in fear. They just want safety. But I think, like you said, you know, there is a bigger, there's more of us than there is of them. And that's, and I think that is only growing by the day. And in many ways, you know, what happened with COVID, that just created an extra so many million more people. Maybe even hundreds of million more people who are tuned into stuff. So even if they throw something else along the way, then we can, even though it can be tough, we can still see that as an opportunity. That's just going to keep rising more of an awakening. And people talk about the Great Reset compared to the Great Awakening. And I'm choosing that path of the Great Awakening more so, and hoping that that's going to be the case for us all. But there's no doubt it's a challenging time. And obviously in Canada, I've looked over from across, you know, across the pond and seeing some of the, how it seems to be even a lot harder. I think Australia was pretty tough as well, looking at there, New Zealand, but Canada particularly. And I noticed, like, you know, a few government leaders around the world have dropped, you know, but Trudeau's still, you know, still there in a place. Do you think that because of how it's been in Canada, you've seen more people push back and more of a rise up of it?
Yeah, but I think in Canada, it's much harder to be vocal and to find each other. There is no large conservative media outlet in Canada on the scale of the mainstream media outlets that dominate the airwaves here. It doesn't exist. All the main news outlets in Canada are controlled by the government here. So CTV News, Global News, CBC, they are all, you know, left-wing outlets that will basically support what the prime minister is doing the majority of the time. And so there is a different kind of work to do here to come together. It takes a lot more meeting up in person. to shake off that feeling like we're, you know, this little radical minority group. You have Rebel News, you know, Rebel News is great, but they are not able to stand up against the major media outlets here. So you have the fact that the media here is so controlled that I think it's still kind of creating the illusion for a lot of people that the majority of Canada, you know, is not against Trudeau, when the majority of Canada is against Trudeau. This is provable, especially because he actually has a minority government. Trudeau is in office right now with only about 30% of the vote. And, you know, this goes back to what you were saying earlier about how strategic and long-term thinking plays into who we're up against. When Trudeau first got into office, one of the promises he made to get his current position as prime minister was that he was going to fix Canada's broken electoral system so that it was no longer this first-past-the-post system, which is essentially what put him in power right now. So in Canada, you have it so that the vote is being divided up between these different parties, like not just between two parties, but between, you know, four, five, and six different parties. It's diluting the Canadian vote so that you can have a minority government like Trudeau. And so he made this promise. It's one of the reasons people got him in. And then as soon as he got into office, he just said, I'm not doing it. Just 100% just wouldn't do it. So he has maintained that broken electoral system that allows him to be empowered by a radicalized minority of Canadians. So in a way, Canada is kind of set up for asymmetrical warfare right now. It is set up to maintain that so that when we have another election, he could still potentially maintain power with a minority. At the same time, you know, you have the conservative opposition here in Canada. Right now, the conservative opposition is Pierre Poilievre. But to an extent, we're looking at someone who's is kind of part of the uniparty. You know, I think when we take away the idea of left and right wing, you want to be looking for the uniparty. Who is supporting this new world order propaganda? You know, who's at least helping it along? There was a bill here in Canada that was, on the surface, we were told it was about stopping conversion therapy. You know, the idea that it's protecting LGBTQ youth from being converted by radical Christians who send them to Bible camps. This wasn't really a problem. Like, there wasn't an actual massive issue with that. You had a few maybe isolated stories that, again, the media amplified. What they were really doing with that was stripping parental rights to say that if you have a child who is gender confused, you can only put them down the affirmative care path. And if you give them any kind of therapy or support that is not the gender affirmative model, then that can be considered conversion therapy and the parents can be fined. They could potentially lose their child. There's all sorts of things. So this bill stripped parental rights. The reason I bring that up is because that was voted in by both the Liberals and the Conservatives in Canada. So if you compare that to the United States, we can't really here rely on the Conservative Party to push back against all of this. They're quite complicit in quite a lot of it. So I think Canadians have a lot of work to find each other in person, to create more in-person events, to get offline to meet each other, because I think that the scale of manipulation with media and the internet here is so massive. Like, Trudeau just passed this bill that makes it so that Canadians can no longer look at news sources on Facebook and Google. So he's already pretty far along in being able to censor Canadians' access to news and information. It's going to come, in my opinion, from dominating the physical domain and not the digital, as far as Canadians go. And so, you know, I have some personal goals to try to create more in-person events in Canada over the next year or so. But I think that will help heal a lot of the disconnect that all the different Canadian freedom fighting groups have from each other right now. I think there is a majority that needs to find each other.
Yeah, I totally agree about those in-person meetups and just connecting with new people, and you just feel alive. You feel, you know, you're not just chatting to someone on the internet. You're not just getting a bit of information and stuff. You're actually there and you're seeing there's other like-minded individuals who you can feel supported with and you can grow out from that. And we're the same over here. We've got a conservative government in England. But it doesn't seem to matter if we had a left or right in at the moment. The same stuff's going to get passed. You know, the big picture of the trajectory, but it doesn't really matter. And I think it's England, Canada, and America have all got first past the post. And every other major country has a different system in place. Because here it doesn't feel like if there is a party you're interested in and they're smaller, your vote is pretty much wasted because it just won't get counted in first past the post. And is it volunteerism that seems to be rising much more? I'm hearing that a lot more from people. And you know, other elements of stuff. And it just, yeah, it's tricky to think. And I also think it's very disempowering to think that if I'm just going to vote every 4 years or whenever it is, and that's the only contribution that some people might make, and you go, well, I voted. And it's, in some ways, it's more, by not voting, in some ways, I feel like I'm curbing more because I'd be voting in a system at the moment that just isn't serving me, my family, my community, the country. You know, it's, as we can see, it serves the corporate interests, it serves the global interests. The thought that governments at the moment are actually supporting their own people is just, you know, it just doesn't seem to weigh up. And when you go back to Canada, I think I've heard Trudeau very much be in praise of sort of how China is run with the social credit score system and how that'll push because, you know, you look in China, they've got total control. There's one party, that's it. So from him, from Trudeau's perspective, that's a dream to think that there's never going to be any opposition.
He said it. He said he admires China's basic dictatorship and the way they can turn things around on a dime. So he does. He admires dictatorships. He's, you know, he's into that. And it showed. It showed when the truckers stood up against him. He became a petty tyrant and the world saw it more explicitly than ever. And now everywhere he goes in Canada, there's people screaming at him, protesting. You know, he really receives quite a bit of hatred. That he's now got to try to spin and deflect. His new narrative is that these people are all influenced by American politics. You know, that's the new narrative. The Canadians aren't thinking for themselves. They're just following conservative Americans. And that's basically his argument at the moment.
Clutching at straws.
Yeah, it's weak. It's very weak because he actually has a lot of Muslim parents standing up against gender ideology in schools right now. That's the narrative he's trying to weave. Instead of them being against this because, you know, it's against their actual religion and the religious text that they adhere to, he's just saying the Muslim parents are just following American right wingers. So that's really insulting, I think. He's probably insulting them pretty intensely. But again, he just needs that narrative to feed his little radicalized base. He's not saying that for us. It's why he can say ridiculous things, because his media apparatus will then go and feed that to his 30%. And he can just keep that little radicalized group within the narrative construct that he's trying to create. And so it's, you know, it's funny because we're also critical of him. We're like, look what he's saying. It's so ridiculous. We can all see through it. But we have to understand that he doesn't care that we can see through it. He's only saying it for the group that he's trying to keep under his influence.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... it's so true. And you mentioned there about Muslim faith and stuff like that, and also Christianity and other things. And one thing it makes me feel about stuff, and I'm not saying it's necessarily the answer the churches have, but it feels very much like the West, the last few decades, we really lost our connection to faith. You know, that's part of, as you're talking about, breaking the family bonds. People, you know, if you go to church, could be a few hundred people there, you get a sense of community, there's a sense of belonging, a sense of guidance in your life. As soon as that's been stripped away, people are just looking at and going, well, my guidance is going to come from the government or from the council. You know, they're going to direct where I'm going to go. And that very much ties into it as well. And I think we're seeing in America, there's a big pushback from religious organizations and stuff. And, you know, I'm not saying that's the hope that we need to have, because I like to think I've got more of a sort of a spiritual mindset to life. So it'd be good to just get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's really nuanced in my opinion, because, you know, if we are moving towards an era, which I believe we are, an era in which we are meant to be rooted in free thought, but in personal sovereignty, right? The sovereignty of the individual. It looks like we are moving into an era that is about the realization of the individual on a very, very deep level, to the extent that each person is meant to develop their own inner authority and make choices for themselves in a very clear way and get to know themselves so deeply that they know how to make correct choices for themselves, as opposed to relying on forms of collectivism, tribalism, to do so. And I think this is part of the divergence from religion, is that in many ways, even though religion, you know, it protected the family to an extent, and it created forms of community and ritual and ceremony that were very beneficial for us. At the same time, the dogma of religion was used to squash individuality. It was used to foment groupthink. It was used to create forms of tribalism that did not always serve us. And I think as we move into this era of the individual being more deeply realized as sovereign and learning to discover that inner authority that is correct for them, then there's going to have to be a balance between one's relationship with religion and the teachings of a religion and one's sovereignty. And I think, you know, this has been a very interesting thing to observe. When I look at the sort of resurgence of Christian voices right now, and those Christians that are trying to find a balance between adhering to the spiritual teachings that serve them and to the Bible and to what they study, and maintaining free thought. And how do you do that, right? This is a very nuanced path. You're walking a razor's edge, because the definition of free thought is the ability to use logic, reason, and empiricism to understand truth without relying on dogma, authority, and tradition. That is the definition of free thought. And so how do you maintain free thought and maintain a connection with a religious text? It's entirely possible, but it's something that each individual has to figure out for themselves. So I think, you know, we are looking at fighting for the family, for example, right? Trying to create ideals for the family unit that are going to last generations, and trying to fight for what the family really means in our culture. Why is the family important? Even like outside of Christianity, why is the family important? Why is it important to have, you know, natural traditional families? What does that do for us? And in my opinion, it has the potential to create these forms of lineage. But it's new from what we used to do in very religious families, in that it can be a lineage based in free thought and the honoring of the individual. And this is where I really encourage families now to do things differently in raising our children. And this is what we're doing as parents, is to get to know your individual child so deeply that you can be of service to who they are as a unique individual, rather than trying to project your values and your ideas onto them, rather than trying to project a particular dogma onto them. You first foundationally have to see the unique nature of that child, especially in the context of the war that we're in, because each child is susceptible to the forms of warfare that are in this world in a way that is unique to that child. I can see it in my two sons, right? They are not vulnerable in the same places when I look at the warfare that is out there that's seeking to influence children. They're vulnerable in places that are unique to who they are. So the way that parenting has to evolve and the family has to evolve is about that unique child. So if you have a Christian household, you know, I still believe that that's a beautiful way to guide a family and to support a spiritual path, as long as it's not used to squash the individuality of that child, to fold them into a dogmatic worldview, which I think that's part of the reason we had a big push away from religion. I think a lot of people felt oppressed by their religious upbringing and they ended up migrating away from that. So, you know, I'm looking to try to support this in two main ways. I really am a big advocate for unschooling. So I don't believe in mimicking the public school model. I believe in unschooling, which is really allowing the unique nature of the child to show you how and where they need to be educated, following their intrinsic desires and passions, and surrounding them with what they are passionate about. So I advocate for that. But also, I'm working on a book and you know, a resource that is going to support families in developing rites of passages for their children, specifically rites of passage, you know, ceremonies and rites of passage, you know, rituals that are born of who that unique child is. And this is a tool that I'm developing to try to share with other families, because I think that is part of balancing what we had with religion that we lost, and what we want to move forward with that religion maybe didn't quite get right. And I think bringing rite of passages and ceremonies back into our children's lives are important, as long as it's rooted foundationally in who that child is first.
You got some examples of the rites of passages that a child might go through that would be beneficial for them? I know you said it would be on an individual basis. Some child, this might suit them, others it might not, but it'd be good to get some perspective on how that might unfold for
absolutely. So, you know, we go through different parts of the life cycle. You know, humans naturally, we have cycles within the life cycle, right? You come upon these different areas of your life that can be either really sort of naturally beautiful or very naturally turbulent or difficult. So I'll give you a few different examples. When our son turned 8, you know, to us, it became clear that for his 8th birthday, that meant he had completed 7 years on Earth. And we wanted to celebrate that 7-year cycle. And we knew that, you know, in a number of different traditions and from a number of different vantage points, there's a lot that happens after 7 years for a child. There's a lot of different forms of psychological growth that solidify who they are, solidifies in certain ways, the sense of potentially entering the community and starting to offer things to the community begins to grow. So we created a very simple rite of passage ceremony for our son. And the main thing that I think people should take away from this idea of creating a rite of passage is that all rites of passage have within them the structure of the hero's journey. And that's actually the foundational structure that I'm using for the book that I'm writing. It's going to use the hero's journey as a map to create rites of passage. So for my son, you know, with the hero's journey, you start off by, you know, you're leaving the familiar world, you know, you're leaving what you've known. And so you want to take a moment to reflect on that familiar world and look back on the life you've led so far to understand what it is you're stepping away from, you know, into the unknown. So we sat with my son and we together watched a slideshow that we had made from the moment of his birth up until the day we were having the ceremony. And we reflected on that. And then we had him light a candle on the table and we sat and we discussed with him, you know, some of the challenges he's been through. He's, you know, he's had some health challenges. He came close to dying when he was very young. So he's had some very, very immense challenges face him in his life. And so we spoke to that and the transformative power of what he's been through so far, and then really, you know, gave him a sense of what we see in his future and how, you know, what we're proud of him having developed and the potential we see in him. And then we celebrated by sitting down together and eating one of his favorite meals and letting him stay up really late with us past midnight and watch a movie he wanted to watch. And you know, it was very impactful for him. So that was a very simple rite of passage ceremony that we made for my son, you know, when he was turning 8. But I think one of the more impactful rite of passage ceremonies is adolescence. And this is where I think it is missing the most, because adolescence is very difficult. It's very difficult because you're being a child and being an adult, and children need a container to move from childhood to adolescence and adolescence to adulthood. This is where I think it's the most impactful. In religion, you know, you're looking at, like, let's say the Jewish tradition, you have the bar mitzvah, okay? So if we look at the hero's journey structure fitting into the bar mitzvah, you know, the bar mitzvah itself, that event, that's just the ceremony. The rite of passage for the Jewish boy is actually when he gets called to first go study the Torah, and he has to go study, you know, with a spiritual teacher, and he has like a rabbi or someone who's guiding him through the text and the meaning of the text. That's when the rite of passage begins. And his struggle is to learn that text, to embody that knowledge. And then the bar mitzvah event That is the end of the hero's journey. That's when he's coming in back into the community, having gone through his journey and his struggle, and he's bringing into the community, here's what I've learned. And he's literally doing the reading of the Torah and sharing like his insights into that spiritual text. And then he is celebrated by his community. That is the hero's journey encompassed. We want to look at being able to do that, whether you're a religious family or not. Taking a framework for a rite of passage and building that for your child based on who they are, you know, that can look a lot, it can look very, very different according to who the child is, according to their interests, you know? So, you know, we have a friend in our community, their son was turning 10 and they decided they wanted to create a rite of passage for him to give him a sense of, you know, moving towards manhood. So the father set him up to do some ice baths with him and his father's friends. He took on the challenge of having no video games for 2 weeks. He is a child who studies martial arts. And so they created a challenge where he had to spar with, I think it was something like 10 different opponents at a time and take on numerous guys at a time. It was about creating these physical challenges. And then at the end of all these physical and mental challenges, they then took him on a little trip, I think to a cabin, and they celebrated with him and sort of brought him into that next stage of boyhood towards manhood. And that was just the family. They created that custom rite of passage for him according to his interests. This is what we want to look at doing, knowing your child deeply enough that you can build a rite of passage that's going to create in them a sense of tension and struggle. It's going to allow them to confront the unknown, to push their limits in terms of responsibility, in terms of, you know, their involvement in the community. And it's going to allow them to come out the other side with a new sense of themselves that you can then celebrate and affirm. And the word affirm is really important to note here, because when you look at the process that a teenage girl goes through when she is transitioned in this whole culture of gender ideology, she is first very confused. She's struggling. She's moving into adolescence. She's come into a new place in her life that's very strange. She doesn't understand it. Then she has people who approach her and say, are you feeling strange? You know, do you want to be a woman? And that girl goes and she looks at Beyonce and she looks at Miley Cyrus and she sees that womanhood is potentially this hypersexual thing and that I have to become hypersexual and allow everyone to sexualize me. And a lot of these girls say, no, I don't want to be a woman. I don't want to be that. So they say, well, you must be a boy then. And so let us help you. So they take her through some rituals. They give her a new name and new pronouns. They offer her the chance to modify her body physically. She actually comes out of this with a new form and a new name. And what happens when she comes out the other side? It's just like the end of that bar mitzvah. Everyone celebrates her in her new identity. This is the structure of the hero's journey. This is the structure of the rite of passage. And the gender transitioning is actually mimicking that, which is one of the reasons why I feel like it's highlighting for us a void in our culture where we are not giving children rites of passage when and where they need them. And I think that's why this could be inserted as an actual practical solution. And it's why I'm working on material to help families do just that.
I think that's got such incredible value to the individuals, the families, and future generations. To you know, even that thing that you're doing with your son, there's an element of, you know, I love that idea of reflecting on stuff. And it's an element of, you know, you talked about his challenges that he's had, a health challenge, and, you know, you almost lost him when he's young. There's a healing to that as well. So they don't have to, it's almost cutting the cords and letting go of some of the things, because you hear about many times, you know, people going to therapy in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and are reflecting back on challenging times of childhood. But if in some way through those rituals and rites of passages, you're acknowledging them and you're giving a container for them to be able to speak up about that and share about that, and having a family that allows people to give them, you know, the feelings are completely valid and everything they've gone through, and to acknowledge that. What a beautiful...
It's about giving... Yeah, like it's about giving struggle meaning, you know? I think this is the thing that's faced by these children in this current generation. They come up against the immense struggle of adolescence and it has no meaning. It seems meaningless. They're like, why am I suffering? What meaning? Because it imbues their struggle with meaning. And that is the biggest gift that I think we need to be giving children right now. And whether you're a religious family or not, it's so important, I think, to really identify your child's struggle so you can help them generate meaning out of it.
And then on the other side of it as well, I just stumbled across a guy this morning called Michael Easter. And he talks about the comfort crisis that we've got, that people aren't even going to the edges anymore. They're just so comfortable just to sit down. I've found recently in the past few years, particularly becoming a father, I'm going to my edges all the time. And I'm realizing that that's where the growth is in life. You know, I don't want to sit back and be comfortable. I want to, you know, push myself and be able to grow. And what you just see in society, you know, you see how many people will sit down most of the time, the obesity epidemic, you've got all these things and it just feels we just become so comfortable. Yes, we have access to so many things. Like I can press a button and then in 6 hours, the food shopping can be delivered. And you can go, oh, wow, isn't that great? You know, when in the past you'd have to go hunting, but there would be something incredible about going hunting and that connection. I'm not saying we're going to shift back to that, you know, full time, but it just makes you think that just because something is comfortable now, and what it tends to be is that you were talking about is what you then do is you just then get distracted with something else. So even though, oh, this is now accessible, but now it's comfortable, you just distract yourself onto other things. And I think there's so much, and that's why I love what you're doing with the Rites of Passages. And it's just that sense of growth. And as you say, the hero's journey. And if you can have that embedded in such a young age, in children as they're growing up, they can have that sense of always wanting to just become better versions of themselves and realize that life is not just how Instagram looks, not how Facebook looks. It's full of really tough challenges all the time. And the more people that can acknowledge that and see that, then I'd like to see that it's going to, you know, it's have ripple effects. And I've got to say, I just admire everything that you've been doing because it is going to have a huge ripple effect. You talk about the butterfly effect. We obviously reach in many thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands, even off millions eventually with your work. Is there any kind of, is there any kind of final thoughts that you can kind of would like to, you know, you touched on so much and I don't want to keep too much of your time, but any thoughts, particularly, I tell you what, first, what's, you know, you talked about what's next for you. Can maybe just go into a little bit more detail of what you, you know, how yeah. What's the plan that you plan to explore?
Sure. So as I said, I'm developing this workbook. So that's essentially, it's going to mimic what I was doing with the custom wedding ceremonies. It starts with a questionnaire, a very detailed questionnaire that is actually structured according to the hero's journey that asks parents questions about their child that's going to help them frame their child as the hero in their journey and help them identify what their child's journey is, where their child's natural struggle is, where are they the hero in their journey. So it's a questionnaire that people will be led through, and then the second part of it will be helping them take the responses from that questionnaire and to construct the rite of passage. So that's a book that I'm hoping to release in the fall. So I'm working on that. I'm also working on a new docuseries called Entrenched. And this is really looking at the evolution of warfare into, you know, what's now called fifth generation warfare. That's the kind of warfare that we're surrounded by, which is really warfare that is designed to make the war itself hidden, to make it hard for people to realize they're in a war, to make it hard for people to realize they're being attacked. That's really one of the most fundamental aspects of fifth generation warfare. And I'm looking to create a docuseries that takes my life and examples from my life and actually reveals what areas of my life I can present as evidence of fifth generation warfare. So for example, I'm sure that you must have seen the story from that teacher here in Canada who had the giant prosthetic breasts. Did you see that? The high school teacher?
Yeah, I've seen some pictures.
Okay, so that's my high school.
Wow.
Okay. So as an example, so for me, there's a lot of reflection here where it's like, from when I went to my high school until that teacher became this like global phenomenon of gender ideology influencing the schools, how did we get there? And to me, the how is you know, forms of communist warfare and forms of fifth generation warfare. So I'm going to be reflecting on my own life to teach people about fifth generation warfare. So that's a docuseries that I'm working on right now. And I'm also heavily involved with Mom Army and Dad Army. People can look up, it's mom-army.com to connect with what they're up to. And Dad Army is a branch of Mom Army that we're developing, and they're on Instagram. So I'm working on that. And I'm touring Cut. So I'm actually looking to get Cut screened in communities to use it to generate community action, to use it to create those physical events. And so I actually am flying out to New Jersey in a couple of weeks to host a screening at a church there and to work with the community in Bridgewater, New Jersey, to try to create some local action and to create this broader perspective outside of the political narratives. And I'm looking to, you know, to tour the film around Canada and really anywhere that people want to have the film, I'm looking to set it up. So that's another big part of what I'm working on right now and looking to refine for the future.
It seems like you've certainly, you touched on right at the beginning, you know, you've certainly found your purpose, haven't you? And you know, you got so much passion behind what you want to do. And it's, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? When you get on a bit of a roll with stuff and the momentum builds, and then who knows what this is going to go to. And, you know, you've got the new projects, but then it's just going to, snowball into something else as well. And so in the end, it's just going to be, you're going to have quite a catalog of amazing things. But also for you, if you've been a filmmaker, you know, to be able to explore your craft and just to develop that craft and that creative side of it as well as exploring it with important topics to you, must feel, you know, I often say to people, you know, if you're doing something that you love and you feel like you're contributing, you're gonna sleep easy, you're gonna rest easy knowing that you're contributing in some way.
Yeah, that's the, you know, for me, it's been about developing a level of self-reliance that has become very powerful, where it's, you know, going deeper into myself and realizing more deeply who I am and allowing that to unfold naturally into what I'm offering in the world has been it's been a crazy experience, and it's been risky as hell. I mean, you know, it has been difficult and I've had to make immense, immense sacrifices, but I just believe so firmly in using self-realization to be of service and getting really, really efficient at that, that I'm sort of willing to take the hits and you know, take the struggle that this is taking for me to get where I know I'm going, because enough has unfolded that it has made my purpose and my path very clear to me. Sometimes to my own detriment, because I can see where it can be and I can see where I'm not yet.
Yeah.
So it's hard to recognize that some of this is necessarily slow, because it's very rich in what has to be transformed in you. And so there's a certain amount of impatience that can sometimes I can get caught up in. But overall, you know, the network that has unfolded around me since I took the leap to just fully commit to what I feel my purpose is, you know, the network that has, you know, sort of exploded around me has been a phenomenon in and of itself, especially releasing Cut. It was just crazy to watch the people reaching out and the networks that formed and everything that has happened to help me with my mission. So, you know, I think people have an opportunity to trust themselves more deeply in terms of discovering their purpose and committing to their purpose. And, you know, do not be afraid to take risks and to take loss and to sacrifice for that, because it will only inform your purpose more richly, in my opinion.
Beautifully said. Well, thank you, Simon. If someone's listening to this now then and they want to find out a little bit more about yourself, I know you said about Dad Army and Mum Army before. Well, how can people actually, you know, check out the documentary, find out more about your previous work and what's upcoming?
Yeah, so if people want to watch Cut, you can go to daughtersofthewestfilm.com. That will give you access to purchase or rent Cut. And if you do end up renting or purchasing it, you actually get a second film for free, a short documentary of mine that is a bonus feature that's called Vague Rules. And that teaches people about some of the ways that communist warfare was imported here into the West. It's about 35 minutes, shorter piece. At daughtersofthewestfilm.com, there's two other things people need to know about. There is the ability to apply for a screening in your community. So you'll see a host a screening section and you can fill out the form there and send that to me and we could chat about creating a screening in your community. And there's also a resources section. And this is something really important, I think, in the fact that this is an information war. A lot of information is censored and suppressed. So for parents and families that are struggling from the influence of gender ideology, I have built a resources section there on the website that will help you find, you know, access to, you know, some of the pushback against this in terms of really good science and data that is showing what's really going on. There's networks of therapists. There's networks of parents who are sharing their experience with their children being influenced by this. There's resources to stop your children from getting onto smartphones and social media when they're too young and helping hold that off until the correct age. So I'm building that library out to try to help families get the resources they need. So check all of that out at daughtersofthewestfilm.com. And to connect with the rest of my work, you can go to simonessler.com, and that will let you browse my whole portfolio of work. You know, I've got all my library of content on Rise TV. So that goes from sort of inspiring docuseries kind of content into this material, kind of flipping this madness on its head and laughing at it. And then my 6-part docuseries, Superorganism, you'll find access to get to that as well. It's actually hosted on a platform called Dauntless Dialogue. But all of that, you can find your way to it through simonessler.com. And I have a new series that's free for people to watch as well. It's called Situational Awareness. I actually just launched that. The series is being hosted on Rumble, and the podcast is on my Substack. People can connect with that through simonessler.com as well. And that's a weekly series where I just unpack everything that's going on from the perspective of modern warfare and help people get oriented towards, you know, solution-based thinking.
Amazing. I'll be sure to include all the links to all of those in the show notes. Well, Simon, I appreciate what you do. I appreciate you for showing up, talking with me today. And yeah, thank you so much.
Cheers. Thanks so much.